We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Welcome. This is Hampton Keithley and Bob Brandon, and we're starting a new series on evolution. How are you today, Bob?
Good morning, Hampton. I'm fine. I got a tweak in my back, so obviously we're not doing video, or you'd see me moving from side to side trying to loosen this thing up. But my health is good. It's a rainy morning here. Yeah, so that's actually nice. You know, we've begun fall. Our summer lasted quite
a while.
What's
the temperature right now?
Ooh, I'd be guessing. Well, let me look at my computer. Says, well, it doesn't say. I'm guessing it's probably in that around 50, maybe, because the you know, the clouds, when it's raining, actually keeps the heat in. So, you know, the coldest days, the coldest mornings are when there's no cloud cover.
Right.
Those clouds act like a big
blanket. You're 50. I just looked my phone. You're 53. We're 64.
Mm-hmm.
So
boy, not too different today. But like you said, so we're gonna dive into evolution. There's a reason for that. You know, the last subject we covered, not in depth at all, but was Karl Marx, right? The founder of, in many ways you could say the founder of communism. Right, wrote the Communist Manifesto. But communism is highly anti-religion, particularly anti-Christianity.
Right.
And if you ask any communist, you know, who's your truth teller, they would say science. And that's happened in our culture as well. Don't you think most people believe the ultimate source of truth in our society are the scientists?
Well, that used to be true till the virus. Now I think a lot of people are questioning that. Well, you mentioned Karl Marx. I don't remember what the name of the book was. Seven People Who Influenced the World the Most. And you know, Darwin and Marx were on that list. So,
My gosh. Yeah. Yeah. Darwin's a really big deal. That is a primary tenet of science in general. Obviously, biology in particular. So let me set it up this way as we continue to walk into this subject. This is going to be really important the next couple of weeks. Really important for people to grasp what we're saying about evolution. So let me begin this way. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So let's skip over to chapter 1, verse 20. God said, let the water swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. God created the great sea creatures and everything living and every living and moving thing with which the water swarmed according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. God saw that it was good. And then, of course, you get to the animals in a few verses. Verse 24, God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, cattle, creeping things, and wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. So you see that repetition of according to its kind, right? So God made all the living things. Ultimately, evolution is not science. I know how strange that might sound to some, but it's a theory of origins. It's trying to explain how we got here. It's really not science. We'll see that more and more as we go forward. It's a theory of origins. It's a worldview that's eliminated God. So the best way, I think, to dive into this is there was a fantastic book written in 1996. That's the year I got married, Hampton.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and we're coming up on my anniversary. Oh, gosh, don't let me forget that.
Okay.
And so this book is by Michael J. Behe. It's Behe. He's a biochemist. I don't know if he's retired now. You know, this was written in 96. He was a biochemist at Lehigh University. And biochemistry's a fantastic niche in science to deal with the issue of evolution. But his book was called, or is called, Darwin's Black Box. It's fantastic. This is one of the most monumental books written in our lifetimes, for certain. It's never been answered. The subtitle is The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. When I say it's never been answered, so from 96 till now, so if enough years have gone by that the science community has responded to Behe, it's earth-shaking what he's saying. So they've responded, but never given an answer. And the reason I'm confident in saying that is I have all Behe's books. So he wrote follow-ups because he'd get feedback, right, in the journals and so on. So he's written maybe three books, you know, subsequent to Darwin's Black Box, and none of them changing fundamentally what he said, just giving more and more details. And the last one, oh, I forget its name, but it's a compilation of all the journal articles written against him. In response, exactly. And so he replies to all of those. And I've read them all through. There is no answer. None of those responses defeat or really even seriously challenge what he's saying. So it's phenomenal. And I think we can cover, you know, maybe we can cover him today. We'll see how good my synopsis skills are. Might take two times, but then we'll go much further than Behe into evolution through our other book, Hampton, Evolution's Achilles Heels. But we'll start with Behe. And let me tell you another thing about Behe's book. He is the clearest science writer I've ever read. I mean, this should be just standard reading for every college biology student. It's so clear. I highly recommend this book. If our listeners don't have it, boy, this is just a fantastic biological meat sandwich. You will learn so much from
this. Well, and I think too, it's simple to understand if that's what you mean, because it's true and he knows his subject, and you know, you don't have to do like Dawkins and talk around things.
That's exactly right. You notice how when people are fabricating an untruth, you get paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs. And when people, just to your point, when they're expressing what really happened, it's very direct and it's very clear quite often, even with what could be considered a complex subject like evolution. So anyway, I just so highly recommend this book. Let me dive in. I've marked the places I want to read. We'll obviously be skipping around, but I'm going to give the nuts and bolts of what he's saying. in a clear enough way that people will be able to grasp this easily. So here's some introductory words. Shortly after 1950, science advanced to the point where it could determine the shapes and properties of a few of the molecules that make up living organisms. Slowly, painstakingly, the structures of more and more biological molecules were elucidated, and the way they work inferred from countless experiments.
But that's when the microscope became powerful enough for them to see.
Exactly right. Exactly right. The cumulative results show with piercing clarity that life is based on machines. Machines made of molecules. Let me pause there for a second. That's in the middle of a paragraph, but what our listeners can't do is see the opening page of this book, not the cover, but the opening page. And it's like a photograph of the flagella on a single cell. And if you didn't have any context, but you just saw that picture and there was no writing, you would say, that's a machine.
Right.
A complex machine. But it is that in the sense, but it's a biological living organism. There's no way you would look at that picture and think that that was assembled by anything other than a very sharp mind. There's no way you would say that randomly came together. Very complex machine. And we'll get into that detail as we read on. But to your point, what evolution was easily sold as initially, you know, this theory of origins, because it only dealt with macro kinds of observations. With the advent,
they thought they thought the cell was a glob of protoplasm encased in a membrane or something like that. Glob of jelly.
At best. And so to this day, most evolution, most of the defense of evolution is macro. For instance, hey, how do we get a giraffe? Oh, well, there was a normal grazer kind of animal, but it really helped it to get the taller leaves on the tree, right? After the low leaves were eaten, boy, it really helped you to have a little bit longer neck. Then you could get those leaves that were higher up. And eventually, you know, so the animals that had a longer neck had an advantage, a health advantage. So they became stronger and out reproduced the stubby neck guys. And inch by inch, those animals, you know, grew up to be
the longer necked ones reproduced.
Yeah, it was advantageous. So you eventually got a giraffe.
I've got a friend, Dr. Job Martin, and he taught biology and evolution at Baylor many years ago. And he's got a book called The Evolution of a Creationist. That's how he came out of that evolution. Uh-huh. And he has this whole, his area. One of the things he does is he goes and talks about the different animals and how they're so specifically designed. And the giraffe is one of those, and how, with, you know, the makeup of the way the blood flows up the neck and all of that is totally different than any other type of animal.
So it's not
just the longer neck. It's the stuff that goes on to make the longer neck work.
It's unbelievably complex to just in a macro sense say, you know, inch by inch, this species became, you know, ultimately represented by a 7-foot neck is the most naive thing you could say in biological terms. It's unbelievably complex. Like you're mentioning just the cardiovascular stuff that has to take place with a neck that long. Here's another one. You know, when you were huffing and puffing at the side of the pool, swim in your laps. You, when you huffed and puffed, you didn't exchange all of your oxygen. Like when you exhale, you're not exhaling all the air from your lungs. You're exhaling a decent percentage, but nowhere near all of it. So that's called, in biological terms, dead space. When you breathe in, you're not breathing in entirely new air, right? There's dead space in that exchange. Well, that's because, your mouth is a foot or so, 12 inches, maybe a little more, from your lungs. You want to try 7 feet of dead space? How does that animal sustain itself with that much dead space of air? See what I'm saying? The macro explanations are so naive. The minute micro explanations that have to take place for that thing to live are incredibly detailed. You can't just grow a longer neck. There are thousands of things that have to take place for that thing to be functional like that. So anyway, let's get back to Behe. So I cut him off in the middle of a paragraph. The cumulative results show with piercing clarity that life is based on machines made of molecules. Molecular machines haul cargo from one place in the cell to another along highways made of other molecules, while still others act as cables, ropes, and pulleys to hold the cell in shape. Machines turn cellular switches on and off, sometimes killing the cell or causing it to grow. Solar-powered machines capture the energy of photons and store it in chemicals. Electrical machines allow current to flow through nerves. Manufacturing machines build other molecular machines, as well as themselves. Cells swim using machines, copy themselves with machinery, ingest food with machinery. In short, highly sophisticated molecular machines control every cellular process. Thus, the details of life are finely calibrated, and the machinery of life enormously complex. So, those two adverbs in that last sentence, finely and enormously, don't even begin to express just how finely and how enormously that stuff happens. It is so incredibly detailed. This is going to be, even setting aside the issue of evolution, exciting reading, was you're going to see with incredible detail how nature, hey, how God put nature together. It's just fascinating to me. So a
Well, and
little
that's
bit.
really the origin of science is Christians in the 1500s that were studying how God did that.
That's exactly right. It's to me, it's one of the favorite branches of all study is biology. And its attendant categories, right? Geology, physics, chemistry, all of that stuff, the sciences, the hard sciences, because you're looking at God's handiwork. Click, clear as a bell. You're trying to reverse engineer, right? How he did it. It's just so
Yeah, that's a
fantastic.
good, I like that. Reverse engineer it.
Yeah. So let me read on because this is exciting. I'm going to make another point here in a few sentences. Can all of life be fit into Darwin's theory of evolution? Because the popular media likes to publish exciting stories, and because some scientists enjoy speculating about how far their discoveries might go, it's been difficult for the public to separate fact from conjecture. To find the real evidence, you have to dig into the journals and books published by the scientific community itself. Let's take a quick pause there. Hampton, you remember our core beliefs. The only thing that'll keep you from understanding an issue or a subject is laziness.
Right.
Everyone's equipped with a brain big enough by far to cover all these subjects. The reason I'm belaboring that is quite often when it comes to science in our culture, a lot of the lay population punt. And they'll just accept whatever's presented in the media as, quote, science, because they'll reason that their background is not in that, and that's complicated stuff. And, oh, the scientists are really smart, and so I've just got to believe them. Don't punt on this subject. Whatever you do, don't punt. Dig in. You can understand this stuff. It's not that complicated in the end. You might have to work at it, but you clearly have the ability to understand this. Don't trust these guys. You got to dig into their literature and get down to the nitty-gritty. You'll find some amazing things. The scientific literature reports experiments firsthand, and the reports are generally free of the flights of fancy that make their way into the spin-offs that follow. In other words, he's saying don't trust the media to report science. You got to go to the journals.
Right.
But as I will note later, if you search the scientific literature on evolution, if you focus your search on the question of how molecular machines, the basis of life, developed, you will find an eerie and complete silence. So I want to open up another book just for a brief moment and address that. So this is a book called Darwin on Trial. It was written by Philip Johnson. I had lunch with Philip Johnson some years ago after he had written this book. And we talked it through. It was very, very interesting. Philip Johnson was the dean of Berkeley Law School. Probably not still alive. Probably not. When I had lunch with him, he was fairly advanced, even at that time. 100% clearly with it, but pretty advanced. So anyway, he has this one remarkable section in that book. His book is very good too, Darwin on Trial. That's recommended reading. So he goes into a gentleman named Colin Patterson. Patterson is a senior paleontologist at the British Natural History Museum and the author of that museum's general text on evolution. So that's a pretty big hitter.
Yeah.
Right. So in this one lecture he gave, he reports saying this to the crowd. The crowd, well, you'll understand who the crowd was composed of in a minute. He says, "Can you tell me anything you know about evolution, any one thing that is true?"
That's an interesting question.
Yeah. When do you hear the response? Yeah. I tried that question on the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History. The only answer I got was silence. I tried it on the members of the evolutionary morphology seminar, the University of Chicago. A very prestigious body of evolutionists. And all I got there was silence for a long time. And eventually one person said, "I do know one thing. It ought not to be taught in high school."
Wow.
That's a room full
of evolutionists.
Evolutionary morphology, the hardest core evolutionists there is. The question put to them, "Can you tell me one thing that's true about evolution?" Dead silence. And then followed by, "We shouldn't be teaching it in high school." That's Colin Patterson saying that, an evolutionist. So when Behe says, when you search the literature, you find an eerie silence. That's poignant.
Well, I want to go back to what you said earlier about, do your own research, read books on the subject. I don't know the statistics, but the majority of people don't read a book after high
Oh
school.
yeah, it's
And
just
so
yeah.
if you do indoctrinate the kids with evolution in high school, then they're never going to read
Question.
anything, to
Yeah.
question it.
Right. They're not going to equip themselves to question it. I tell you, even as you made those comments, my mind was going back to probably my favorite thing ever was having a child and being able to read with my daughter and sit her on my lap. And just, you start out with kids' stories. Man, that was just paradise to me. But I just felt responsible to equip her that by the time she was an adult, she knew how to read. Because if you know that, then you can learn whatever you need to learn. So, how fun was that? So anyway, I'm going to continue on with Behe here. After he says there's an eerie and complete silence, the complexity of life's foundation has paralyzed science's attempt to account for it. Molecular machines raise an as yet impenetrable barrier to Darwinism's universal reach. To find out why, in this book, I will examine several fascinating molecular machines, then ask whether they can ever be explained by random mutation and natural selection. He's given the nuts and bolts of how evolution is explained.
You're
You
back in,
take
you're in Behe's book.
Behe's book.
Is
So
he the
you,
one with the mousetrap, irreducible complexity?
yes. So we're going to explain that in a few minutes. But natural random mutation and natural selection are the levers that drive evolution. That's how it's proposed to work. That your children, right, they don't look exactly like you. Right? They're different. So you get mutation in that sense. You get genetic variation in your offspring. And so then nature selects the most capable offspring, and eventually you get new species and so on. So that's how evolution is proposed to work. So let's continue on with Behe, and we'll get to your mousetrap thing momentarily. In fact, maybe I'll jump to that. So here's his basic illustration. It's really powerful. I've had mice in my garage, Hampton.
Who hasn't?
And that's no good because, it doesn't bother me that much that it's in the garage, although that's not good. But you open that garage door and leave it, you go somewhere in your garage and your door's open for a little bit. One of those things runs into your house. Now you've got them in your house. And that's a problem. So we use mouse traps to get rid of them, and that thing's remarkably effective. And there are in the standard mouse trap that every listener is envisioning now in their mind, maybe five basic components to that device, to that machine, we could say. There's the wooden base, right? There's the platform, there's the spring. There's the hammer that crushes the mouse once he's caught in that thing. There's a latch and the connection for the latch, right? So then you put your bait on there. Mouse smells the bait, walks over there. Hopefully your smell isn't on it, right? Just the bait. And whap, that hammer comes down, traps the mouse, kills it usually, but it at least traps it. If you take, well, let's say it this way. say I'm catching 5 mice a week with that mousetrap. If I remove one of those basic elements, one of the 5, how many mice do I catch? 4.
None.
3. You catch 0 because they all have to be there working in the, you know, integrated into the machine, or you don't get any results. So the technical term for that, and B, he spends, you know, 4 or 5 pages detailing everything I just said, but the technical term for that is the mousetrap, as simple as it is irreducibly complex. You cannot build it step by step in the form of evolution and then finally get to a working mousetrap. It goes from 0 to 100. It doesn't go 0 to 25 to 50. It doesn't work unless all of that stuff is there. You can't create it by slowly random mutations that accumulated in a beneficial way over time and produce a mousetrap. You can't.
Right.
There are hundreds, if not thousands, of those things in a human body. When I say those things, I mean irreducibly complex systems.
And well, there's several in each cell.
Oh, yeah. Even within the simplest living organism, a cell, a single cell.
Right.
There are numerous irreducibly complex systems. And, you know, the mousetrap is such a simple example. The ones inside a cell are really complex. They're not these little 5 basic components. Like, well, in some senses, there can be 5 or less, in a sense, components, but none of those components themselves are simple. So right. We'll look at that stuff in detail. So, but we've already let the cat out of the bag. You cannot evolve that, no matter how hard those guys try. And they don't try. That's what he means by there's an eerie silence about this subject amongst the evolutionists, because they know they can't explain that. And not even can't explain, they know that it's defeating.
Right.
That it couldn't evolve. But we're going to go to some examples to just drive these points home, and you're going to learn a lot about swimming today. Hampton.
Okay.
How about that? So let me find a section where he starts to talk about a psyllium. Do you remember your Latin?
I never knew Latin.
So
I went to public school.
So psyllium as opposed to cilia. When you say psyllium, that's singular. When you say cilia, that's plural.
Okay.
Okay. So he goes in for a few pages describing you, Hampton, in a pool and what you have to do in order to swim.
When right? I swim, I look silly. Is that what you're trying to say?
I knew you'd come up with some kind of joke. So you didn't start out looking very good, but you got to where you were looking pretty good, pretty quickly. So
I had a good coach.
He's describing what you have to do to move in a liquid medium. So I'm going to skip all that and get to the psyllium. But we're going to be reading Behe for a while, and some of this is going to get technical. But again, he is the clearest writer, so you'll be able to get it. But it's important that we get this material down. Some cells swim using psyllium. So pause there for a sec. A cell, a single cell. And that's his point with the title of his book, Darwin's Black Box. The cell is Darwin's black box. Because on a, like we said with the giraffe, on a macro level, you can spin a lie about how that.
Does he explain why he uses black box as the term?
Yeah, just
Because
that was used in science. You know, that was a metaphor that people used to not be able to explain something,
you couldn't see
right?
in, you could not see inside it.
Correct. Correct. You
Okay.
could use, you know, the other thing you could use would be an analogy, like one of my favorite ones. I'm not a movie guy, Hampton, but I have seen The Wizard of Oz. So when the Toto, the little dog, pulls back the curtain and you see the guy moving all the levers to create the fantastic flaming head, you realize, oh, so in other words, what's behind the curtain? So that's the same metaphor as the black box.
Okay.
Okay. So even the smallest of simple, quote, simple cells has unbelievably complex stuff in it. So some cells swim using psyllium. Psyllium is a structure that, crudely put, looks like a hair and beats like a whip. If a cell with psyllium is free to move about in a liquid, the psyllium moves the cell much as an oar moves a boat. If the cell's stuck in the middle of a sheet of other cells, the beating psyllium moves liquid over the surface of the stationary cell. Nature uses cilia for both jobs. For example, sperm use cilia to swim. In contrast, the stationary cells that line the respiratory tract each have several hundred cilia. The large number of cilia beat in synchrony, much like the oars handled by slaves on a Roman galley ship, to push mucus up to the throat for expulsion. The action removes small foreign particles like soot that are accidentally inhaled and stick in the mucus. So that's his first paragraph. That's pretty clear, right? He's a good painter as a writer. He paints a picture you can see in your mind. So, I mean, he's such a valuable author. I mean, this guy's done such great work. Light microscopes show thin hairs on some cells, but discovery of the Lilliputian details of cilia had to wait for the invention of the electron microscope, which revealed that the cilium is quite a complicated structure. I'll be discussing the structure of the cilium for the next few pages, blah, blah, blah. So let me skip to his discussion. The cilium consists of a membrane-coated bundle of fibers. The ciliary membrane is an outgrowth of the cell membrane. So the interior of the cilium is connected to the interior of the cell. When a cilium is sliced crossways and the cut end is examined by electron microscopy, you see nine rod-like structures around the periphery. So let me pause there. So initially, right, you say, oh, it's a hair. A cilium is like a hair follicle. Well, once you cut it open and you can look in even more, there's nine structures inside that hair-like structure.
Wow,
So,
that's a
yeah.
powerful microscope.
Oh, man. The rods are called microtubules. When high-quality photographs are closely inspected, each of the nine microtubules is seen to actually consist of two fused rings. So you see the multiplication factor, right?
You
Now
got
it's,
eight, yeah, now there's
yeah.
18.
Yeah. Oh, it's a hair. No, there's nine, and then there's two times nine. Okay. Further examination shows that one of the rings is made from 13 individual strands. The other ring joined to the first is made from 10 strands. So now what are we up to? Don't bother doing the math. Just you can
23
just
times
realize
18.
this thing is so, the simplest structures are so complex, Hampton. But there's so much beauty in it that God has created even these microscopically minute things in such detail. So let's read on. The other ring Oh, it's made of 10 strands. Summarizing briefly, each of the nine outer microtubules of psyllium is made up of a ring of 10 strands fused to a ring of 13 strands. Biochemical experiments show that microtubules are made from a protein called tubulin. In a cell, tubulin molecules come together like bricks that form a cylindrical smokestack. So let's pause. So now, not only do you have all these hundreds of tubes, but now he's going to go into what the tubes themselves are made up of. And that's a protein called tubulin. So imagine like a smokestack, tall, narrow tube. Each of the nine outer rods is a microtubule that resembles a fused double smokestack with bricks of tubulin. Pictures produced by electron microscopy also show two rods in the middle of the psyllium. They too are microtubules. Instead of being double smokestacks, however, they are individual smokestacks, each made of 13 strands of tubulin. So for the reader, if you were looking at this book, then he has that picture on the page so you can visually see what he's talking about. Let me just read, instead of trying to create the picture in your mind, I'm going to let your mind put it together, and I'm just going to read the contents of this picture, the labels. Okay. There's an outer dynein arm, an inner dynein arm. There's nexin. There's subfiber B, subfiber A. There's a central singlet microtubules with a connecting bridge. There's a plasma membrane. There's a radial spoke. There's a spoke head. There's a protofilament. Okay. What I want you to picture is the perfect complexity of the simplest structure you can imagine, like a hair follicle.
Yeah, that's just one little hair on the cell.
Yes. And that stuff all has to be integrated perfectly. And it is. So let me read on. When conditions are right within the cell, for example, when the temperature is within certain limits, and when the concentration of calcium is just right. So, more complicating factors, but let's just assume that all those are, in their right, parameters. Tubulin, the brick that makes up the smokestacks, automatically comes together to form microtubules. The forces that bring tubulins together are much like those that fold an individual protein into a compact shape. Positive charges attract negative charges. Oily amino acids squeeze together to exclude water, and so forth. One end of the tubulin molecule has a surface that's complementary to the opposite end of the second tubulin molecule, so the two stick together. A third tubulin can then stick onto the end of the second molecule, a fourth onto the end of the third, and so on. As an analogy, think of stacking tuna cans. In the grocery store where my family shops, the tuna cans, because the bottom's beveled and is the same diameter as the straight edge top, they snack snugly, one on top of the other. If the stack is gently bumped, the cans remain in place. If two tuna cans are stacked top to top instead of top to bottom, though, they don't stack securely and can be moved by a casual bump. So
Right.
anyway, right, he's just trying to explain how detailed even these smallest of things are. Like even when we say, oh, there's a protein nexin, or there's a protein dynein, those proteins themselves are unbelievably complex. Really, they are. If you've ever seen pictures of those, they're these long strands all folded and twisted, and it looks like, to the untrained eye, just a messy, piece of spaghetti. All those shapes have to be exactly what they are. They're not messy. That's all those shapes are communicating information, because they'll hook together or not hook together depending on their shape, and they'll hook with the right thing or not hook with the right thing depending on their shape. So all these variations are needed for this kind of construction. Again, even of one of the simplest things there is, a hair follicle on a single cell, a cilium. Unbelievably complex, and it all has to be there in perfect order and create. By the way, these things are created by the cell, right? The cell's not going out looking for this sort of stuff. It's got to be transported into the cell, and then the cell creates all the machinery to create these special proteins that, you know, build this tubulin that then builds the quote smokestacks. It's just incredible. So I'm going to skip the rest.
You don't have a hair that's just a single strand, and then it mutates and makes a double strand, and that's stronger.
Correct.
You know.
Yeah, that's not how it goes. That's exactly right. And then how it moves, how it creates the motion. You know, so, you know, think about making a smokestack, but then think about bending that smokestack.
Well, I'm thinking about copper wire. You know, you have a copper wire with a plastic sheath around it, and if that is just one piece of copper, and if you bend it, then it breaks after you've bent it several times. But if you have real fine braided copper, then you can bend it and bend it and bend it, and it doesn't break.
Yeah. And then, Hampton, on top of that, think, you know, usually even as you describe that illustration, you're bending, the electrician's bending it. Imagine it bending itself according to what it wants to do.
Right.
And the complexities that that would involve.
Yeah, the electrician designed, you know, they figured out this, you know, what is it, multiple, what's the old illustration? Three strands are harder to break.
You know, a cord of three strands is hard to break.
Somebody figured that out. It didn't just happen.
Correct. Yeah, all of that is taking a human engineer to do, right, with copper wires. This is a single cell doing this, in a sense, on its own, creating this hair-like follicle that can move it through water or move water over its surface. You know, so to beat in rhythm, to be able to flex backward and forward as it should without breaking, this, I just can't even describe the complexity of this. And how well it works. And again, every part of this thing has to be there in working fashion. It can't kind of build half a smokestack, and it can't kind of be close to the other one. All of this stuff has to be exactly positioned. Every element has to be there. It's irreducibly complex. And it's not just five items like a mousetrap. It's, you know, Behe does such a good job of expressing the complexity. But even then, you're just summarizing to make it understandable to the human mind. It's way more complex than Behe's even describing. And it all works perfectly. You could not evolve that. And it had to at some point, if evolution is true. And at the end of the chapter, then he talks about the flagella. So this is what we're talking about now, is just the cilium. When you get into the flagellum, it's a couple layers more complex than the cilium. And again, if you saw a picture of it, you would say it clearly that was manufactured. It didn't just randomly happen, and it very much looks like your brain would instantly interpret it as a machine.
Right.
Literally, let me just say it again. Evolution cannot have happened. That is not how we got here. That's not up for debate. There's no way that this kind of stuff has never been answered in the last 25 years. There is no answer for it.
Right.
Due to technical difficulties, we lost audio. So that's the end of this podcast. We will see you next time.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.